From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I recorded this podcast on March 10th, 2019. I've chosen three articles that have come out this week that I think are very relevant to our practices and certainly things that I encounter in my daily work. One of them is a nice summary of postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS, which came out in JACC. Another is a look at the potential value of direct oral anticoagulation in patients with mitral valve stenosis. And last, I want to go through a trial that was published this week in Lancet looking at the enhanced control of hypertension in patients who've received thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke. So let's get started with POTS. This is a nice review, and I'm just going to give you eight or nine key points about POTS. As you know, this is a syndrome of orthostatic intolerance characterized by heart rate increment, 30 beats or more, often with standing heart rates greater than 120 beats per minute, and this is occurring within 10 minutes of standing up or head-up tilt. And, importantly, the absence of orthostatic hypotension, which is defined as the drop of greater than 20 millimeters systolic or 10 meters diastolic. It is the most common form of orthostatic intolerance in young people. Presyncope is much more common in these patients than syncope, although some of these individuals have neural-mediated reflex syncope along with POTS. Cardiovascular deconditioning is a universal feature in POTS, but remember there can be overlapping pathophysiologic variants that can increase individual susceptibility to POTS, like autonomic neuropathy, excessive venous pooling, or hypovolemia in the setting of volume dysregulation, a hyperadrenergic state, and several others. There are some chronic symptoms and comorbidities that cannot physiologically be explained by the orthostatic intolerance or tachycardia, and these are common in POTS and are often frustrating to treat. They include chronic fatigue, dizziness, syncope, migraines, functional GI disorders, chronic nausea, fibromyalgia, and joint hypermobility. Importantly, POTS should be differentiated from neurogenic orthostatic hypotension, which can occur in Parkinson's, Lewy body dementia, pure autonomic failure, and other autonomic neuropathies. With orthostatic hypotension, there should be at least a 20-point drop in systolic blood pressure by 3 minutes of tilt, and typically the heart rate increment is minimal. So POTS, of course, tachycardia, not so much on the orthostatic hypotension, and this is differentiated from these other disorders. Formal autonomic testing can be quite helpful in looking for signs of autonomic impairment and to differentiate POTS from these other conditions. In terms of treatment, I guess actionable knowledge item one would be exercise conditioning for these patients. And they can do this in a recumbent way with swimming or recumbent bike or rowing, for example. This is differentiated, of course, from upright exercise that can potentiate the tachycardia. Medications can be useful for patients with severe symptoms, but these are not ideal. Propranolol, midodrine, pyrostigmine, fludrocortisone have been used, but hopefully with conditioning, this often is improving patients' situation. Additional things we can do for these patients is to increase blood volume by drinking 3 liters of water per day and liberalizing salt to 5 to 10 grams of sodium every day. They should avoid large and heavy meals, alcohol, and heat exposure, and compression stockings up to the thighs or even higher, and even abdominal binders may be useful for some of these individuals. Also, sleeping with the head of bed elevated and performance of physical countermaneuvers like leg crossing or squatting can be helpful in patients. And finally, some patients benefit from behavioral and cognitive therapy, particularly dealing with things like anxiety and so forth. So POTS, it's an interesting syndrome that we see. It's sometimes frustrating to treat, and this is a very nice review. Okay, let's go back then and look at this paper that came out in JACC this week from Korea. And the question is, what is the efficacy of direct oral anticoagulants in patients with mitral valve stenosis? And as you know, there's a paucity of data in this space. So they used the Health Insurance Review and Assessment Service database from Korea to identify patients who had both mitral stenosis and atrial fibrillation, who were prescribed either DOAC therapy or warfarin. And in this database, they used a one-to-one propensity matching arrangement. Now, the endpoint of interest was ischemic stroke or systemic embolism, and the primary safety endpoint was intracranial hemorrhage. In the database, they found over 2,000 patients, mean age of about 70, 31% male, that were included. And when they looked at what happened over time, thrombotic events occurred in about 2% per year in the DOAC group, compared to more than 4% per year in the warfarin group. And interestingly, intracranial hemorrhage was lower, 0.49% per year in the DOAC group versus almost 1% per year in the warfarin group. So the authors concluded that in this database analysis, the use of DOAC appeared to potentially offer promising therapy in patients who have mitral stenosis. Obviously, current recommendations regarding DOAC use are limited to patients who have non-valvular AFib. And of course, this excludes mechanical valve replacement or patients with moderate to severe mitral stenosis. So they don't currently receive DOAC therapy typically. And this Korean study certainly suggests that it might be possible that DOAC therapy is not only safe, but as efficacious as warfarin. And any retrospective analysis like this really begs then for prospective data, and particularly randomized data in patients with AFib. I thought it was a great article, and it certainly is fuel for a big trial to evaluate this possibility. Lastly today, then, let me talk to you about ENCHANTED. This is a study looking at enhanced control of hypertension in patients who've had thrombolysis for stroke. So the description of the trial, the goal was to evaluate whether intensive blood pressure lowering compared with usual care among patients receiving alteplase for acute ischemic stroke would improve outcomes. It was randomized, parallel. Patients with ischemic stroke receiving treatment with IV alteplase were randomized to intensive blood pressure lowering versus usual care. The intensive group, the target systolic pressure was 130 to 140 millimeters of mercury within 1 hour of thrombolysis. And in the usual care group, the target systolic pressure was to try to keep the systolic number under 180 millimeters per mercury within 72 hours of thrombolysis. There were over 2,000 patients enrolled. They followed them up for 3 months, the mean age 67 years. About 40% were women, and 20% or so were diabetics. The inclusion criteria were acute ischemic stroke of mild to moderate severity. Patients had to be adult age greater than 18, and they had to have a systolic pressure greater than 150 when they were enrolled. Exclusion criteria, obviously patients who had a contraindication to thrombolysis, patients with very high blood pressures, that is greater than 185 systolic, patients with poor prognosis or a pre-existing disability that would make functional outcome assessment difficult. So the primary outcome was improvement in functional status at 90 days, and that was similar between the two groups. However, when they looked at secondary endpoints, any intracranial hemorrhage occurred in 14.8% of the intensive blood pressure control group versus about 19% in the usual care, and that reached statistical meaning. Also, fatal intracranial hemorrhage occurred in 0.5% in the intensive group and over 1% in the usual care group, also a borderline statistically important finding. And serious adverse events were similar. By the way, the on-treatment systolic pressure was 144 in the intensive group versus 150 in the usual group. So the authors concluded that in patients with acute ischemic stroke of mild to moderate severity undergoing intravenous alteplase therapy, intensive blood pressure lowering was not associated with any improvement in functional status at 90 days compared to usual care. However, intensive blood pressure lowering was associated with an apparent reduction in the amount of intracranial hemorrhage and a non-significant trend in the endpoint fatal intracranial hemorrhage. Obviously, this excluded patients with very high blood pressures greater than 185, where the current guidelines would recommend that we get them down. I think the whole area of hypertensive management and stroke is fascinating. We have this sense that autoregulation of brain blood flow really requires higher levels of pressures in these patients. And you can view this particular trial one of two ways. You can say there's no change in functional outcome, or you can say, well, actually there was some benefit in terms of intracranial hemorrhage. Certainly, this argues that it's probably safe to target a blood pressure in the range of 140 or so in these individuals, but the authors were not able to show a statistically improvement in the benefit on functional outcome at 3 months. So three articles today. We talked about ENCHANTED, the study looking at hypertension control in stroke. We talked about use of DOACs in patients with mitral valve stenosis, and a review of POTS, which is often a vexing problem in our clinics. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org, and you can find these articles and journal scans on the website. Also, look for a new educational catalog featured on ACC.org. You'll find it under Education and Meetings. You can use this tool to sort our educational offerings by various formats. And, of course, most of these are free. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a good week.